Lawmakers in Columbus have been busy during this lame duck session. Religious instruction and expanded fracking are on the agenda. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. Cincinnati-based Kroger's bid to buy rival Albertsons imploded this week thanks to a pair of court rulings. Police arrested four people related to the Big Mac Bridge fire, and Cincinnati Public Schools made moves toward restructuring where kids will go next year. That's coming up later in the hour, but first, back to the state capitol. The House and Senate have been passing bills allowing students to leave schools for religious instruction and opening up a state park for fracking. I frankly can't keep it all straight, but luckily I don't have to. We've got Ohio Public Radio State House Bureau Chief Karen Kassler here to lay it all out for us. Welcome, Karen.
Hey, great to be here, Tana.
All right. Give us sort of the broad overview of how many bills and things have been going on during this lame duck session. And we should say, you know, lame duck session, that's where some lawmakers are wrapping up their terms and new folks are going to be installed in the new year.
Well, we've got about 1,000 bills that have been proposed in the last 2 years. Now, the large majority of those, I mean, most of those will not go anywhere. And bills that are being proposed currently, ones that have come in the last couple of months, they're very unlikely to go anywhere. But there are some bills that are still here that are close to the finish line. And that's what lawmakers are doing now, is to try to figure out how to get the ones that they want to get passed through, because, you know, things have to go through the House and the Senate. There's a procedure here. And they're trying to rush through a lot of this before they end their session, which they plan to do on Wednesday.
Is there a reason why they want to kind of rush them through before the end of the session? Why not just wait until the new folks are in place?
Well, that would mean starting the whole process over.
Oh.
And while a lot of these bills express ideas and cover things that Republican lawmakers who will be in the supermajority again want, that could certainly happen. A lot of these bills that don't pass will be reintroduced. But if you want the bill to go forward, since you've already done a whole lot of committee hearings and that kind of stuff on it, now's the time. It's do or die, or else the bill dies at the end of the 2 year session.
All right, let's get down to it. Thanks for explaining that. Start with a big one that people have been calling a parental bill of rights. Can you give us what's the headline on this bill?
Well, the Parents' Bill of Rights, as it's called, is House Bill 8, which, if it's got a low number like that, it means it's a priority bill. It's a bill that was identified as a priority early on, back in January, February of 2023. So this is a bill that's been sitting around for a while. And this would require that parents are notified if there's any sort of content that's described as sexuality content in public K through 12 schools, so that parents can pull their kids out of those classes if they want. And it would also require that school employees, so teachers, principals, administrators, counselors, any school employee would have to notify parents if there are changes in a child's physical or mental health, such as if they've asked for counseling. And so those provisions have certainly galvanized conservatives, who say parents have the absolute right to know what's going on in their schools. They have the right to get involved if they object to something that's being taught. But LGBTQ advocates and the teachers unions have said this is potentially a problem for kids who are troubled. They'll likely have less access to resources, and this could almost force school employees to out those children to their parents, which the advocates say is a real problem.
What's the mechanism for enforcement on that?
That's a really good question. Since it hasn't passed, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
But it's one of these bills that is interesting to know, because, as I mentioned, LGBTQ advocates are very concerned. They say that, hey, this is about parents' rights in schools and making sure that parents have these sorts of ways to control what's happening with their children. But then the legislature also passed a bill that said that parents of minor children who want to transition cannot get access to gender transition treatment. So they'll point to that as being kind of not the same thing. Mm. And I should add, too, that this bill has been modified. A Ohio Senate committee has not voted it out of committee yet, but has decided to change it to add a provision in there that would require school districts to allow students to be released from school during the day to go to religious education classes.
Right.
And
tell us about
Governor
that.
Governor Mike DeWine has said that he supports a uniform policy throughout the state, because you do have some school districts that are now pulling back on their involvement, specifically with a program called LifeWise, It's an Ohio-based Bible-focused Christian education program. And you might recall seeing the bright red buses that say LifeWise on the side, transporting kids from school to classes that are off campus. And the push is on from Republicans to get that bill in there. And certainly Democrats are concerned about that.
What are they saying? What are the opponents saying about that bill?
Well, it's the idea of this is happening during school, that school should be about school and not about things that are happening off campus. And why can't this be something that happens after school or before school? But that's actually one of the promotional taglines of LifeWise, is that it's happening during the school day, that kids are actually using periods where they're at lunch or recess or something else and learning in these Christian education programs. It's interesting, the history of these is that, or the history of this idea of kids leaving school for religious education actually started with kids in Northeast Ohio who were leaving school for Jewish education classes. So this has really kind of gotten bigger since then.
And are they missing, I mean, I know you said recess or lunch or whatever, so are they missing actual class time? And then, like, do their teachers go with them?
Well, no, they have to do this during classes that are not core curriculum classes. But some teachers will make the point that if a kid leaves school, it's harder to get the kid back focused on school when they return. And there's a concern that kids are, it's another way for kids to have peer pressure and maybe even bully each other. And it's for teachers who are opposed to this, this is a really complicated scenario. It's not as easy as just the kids get on the bus and then they come back and everything's fine. But the supporters of this say this is really important, and they feel that parents should have the right to say that they want their kids to have this education during the day.
Mm-hmm. Is there like a larger education legislation trend here nationwide that this is part of?
Well, LifeWise is a big program. I think it's in 29 states. Mm. So it is really branched out. And the whole idea behind happening during the day is because the organizers say there's too many things going on after school. Kids are involved in dance and sports and all sorts of other things. And even on the weekends, that getting this kind of education should happen during the school day, because kids are in the mood for education, I guess, at that time. But this is one of these that we're watching here. House Speaker Jason Stevens supported the initial Parents' Bill of Rights before the addition of this LifeWise amendment. And he says he wanted a clean bill, a bill that sends a message about parents' rights. And he's expressed some concerns about this LifeWise amendment. So it remains to be seen whether this goes forward.
Yeah, actually, I was going to just ask you when they might vote on this. But, you know, is it really common for bills to get kind of smushed together and
Oh, yeah. At the end of the session, when you're trying to get a lot of pieces of legislation through, and again, you've got bills that have been proposed that haven't gone fully through the committee process, and some of those provisions in those bills will get added into bills that are close to passing. For instance, this week we had a bill that would ban a requirement that gun owners carry liability insurance. And Republicans tried to add another law, or another proposed law, that would, it's called the Second Amendment Preservation Act, that would make sure that federal government could not use state and local officials to enforce federal gun laws. That was, they were trying to add that to the liability insurance law, well, or proposal, and that was scrapped. So you do have these kind of motions that are happening throughout lame duck session because the time is short to get measures passed.
Do they have until like December 31st, or, you know, do they like go on recess at, I don't know, the 24th or something? How long?
Well, technically they do have until the end of the year, but nobody wants to be around here for Christmas and New Year's. So they try to break as soon as they can once they feel like everything's done. And, you know, some of these bills will remain and we'll have to start over again, because really the composition of the legislature is not going to change all that much. Republicans still maintain control. And in fact, Speaker Jason Stevens will no longer be Speaker, but Senate President Matt Huffman will likely be Speaker. And Huffman is leaving the Senate in the hands, most likely, of Senator Rob McCauley. He will likely be president. He and Huffman are very closely aligned on issues. So some of these things that have been held up in the last 2 years because of this conflict between Stevens and Huffman will probably start moving forward in the next session.
All right. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. We're speaking with Karen Kassler at the State House News Bureau. Early in the week, you attended the Oil and Gas Land Management Commission meeting, where environmental activists from the group Save Ohio Parks attended as well in holiday costumes, and they sang some revised Christmas carols encouraging a vote against allowing fracking in state parks. Let's take a listen to the sound that you brought back.
Good tidings to you and all of your kin. Good tidings, stop fracking and a healthy new year.
Good tidings, stop fracking. Were lawmakers moved by this display, Karen?
Well, this is a 5-member commission that is basically required in state law to approve permits that energy companies submit for the permission to frack and drill on state lands, and that includes state parks. It's a long process, so that particular group, which is known as Save Ohio Parks, has been doing this for about a year. They come to all these commission meetings dressed in costumes, and they're trying to be disruptive in a way, because they're trying to get the attention of people who are at the meeting and of the commissioners themselves, in the hopes that commissioners will vote not to allow some of these permits. But I'm not sure whether the commissioners are basically, their hands are tied, essentially. But some of the commissioners do have ties to the energy industry. So they were hoping this time that the panel would not vote to start the permit process for about 900 acres of the Salt Fork State Park, which is a pretty big state park. The commission went ahead and allowed for the bid process, the permit process, to be opened. And that means that bids will come in. And those companies that bid, we're not allowed to know who they are. That process is sealed as this goes through. The commissioners also did allow for a company, Gulfport Appalachia, which is based in Oklahoma, to start drilling and fracking in 30 acres of a wildlife area in Northeast Ohio, and then also some land that's owned by the Ohio Department of Transportation.
Okay, so these decisions just apply to those two, but the ruling that they have to adhere to applies to like all of any state land.
Yeah, that was a law that was changed last year that just basically changed a word in state law that said changed a word from may allow permits to shall allow permits. So that really was intended to make the process of getting permits to drill on state land easier. And one of the other bills that is still waiting in the lame duck session would extend those leases that those energy companies get. The leases are now 3 years if they win. This would extend it to 5 years. And that bill is really interesting because it started out as a bill that had widespread bipartisan support, a bill that would rename or put under the umbrella of green energy, nuclear energy. I mean, Democrats were supportive of that idea. As it went through the process, this idea of adding a length of time onto permits for fracking in state parks was put in. And Democrats then started to oppose this, including the Democratic sponsor of the bill, Sean Brennan, who's from Northeast Ohio. He voted against his own bill because he did not want this fracking provision to be added to it.
Okay. So we don't know who's going to be doing the fracking yet, but do we know how soon they may start?
It takes a long time to get this going, but fracking is going on. Drilling is going on, especially in Northeast Ohio, in that area, the shale area of the eastern part of the state. And advocates for this say, hey, you don't even know it's happening. You won't see it. It's not like they set up a big drill in the middle of a state park. You won't even know. But environmental activists like those that we started this out with, who come up with the revised Christmas carols, say this is really potentially damaging to the environment. It can hurt water. It can hurt. It can lead to all sorts of other environmental issues. And so they really want to see this stopped, especially in state parks.
And is this a done deal, or could we see some last minute wrangling still, you think?
Oh, I think the process of allowing drilling and fracking in state parks will continue. The question will become, I think, if it becomes visible, what will happen? Mm-hmm. If it starts to be a problem, then what will happen in terms of state lawmakers? But the state is actually making pretty good money on this. And the state park system, the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, is able to use some of that money to renovate some buildings in the parks. So there is a benefit to the state to this. And so that's one reason why it's happening.
All right. Thank you, Karen.
Great to talk to you.
Karen Kassler is our bureau chief at the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Up next, the merger between Kroger is history. Albertsons is suing now. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Tayana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. Four suspects face charges in relation to the Big Mac Bridge fire. Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight joins us now with more on who they are and what we know about the fire. Welcome back to the show, Cameron.
Good to be here.
Awesome. All right, briefly recap what happened with the bridge. Pretend somebody has never heard what we're talking about.
Yeah, so on November 1st, a fire broke out at the 1,000 Hands Playground under the Big Mac Bridge, or as it's officially called, the Daniel Carter Beard Bridge, the big yellow bridge that connects Cincinnati to Kentucky. And the fire was extremely hot, extremely big, and it caused a lot of damage to the 471 lead up to the Daniel Beard Bridge. I think most people would consider it a fire that occurred under the bridge, but it's technically not directly under the actual bridge, but right. The lead up to it.
And then, go ahead.
Yeah. So we waited about 5 weeks to hear anything about any of it. It was under investigation. And then, in a flurry of activity, at the beginning of this week, there were four arrests that were made. First, Caitlin Hall was arrested. She was arrested on an obstruction of justice charge. And then we learned about the arrest of Zachary Stumpf and Terry Stiles. They are the people accused of actually setting the fire intentionally. And then shortly after their arrests were announced, became public through court records, a fourth person named James Hamilton was arrested. He's also arrested on obstruction charges. And Hall and Hamilton are both kind of accused of misleading investigators and not necessarily telling them information that they wanted to know as they were trying to locate Stumpf and Stiles.
Okay.
So that's sort of where we're at.
Right. Okay. So what do we know about Stumpf and Stiles?
Well, they were, according to officials, they were held up in an attic. They had to use a drone to find them.
Oh, like a heat sensing drone?
I don't know. I'm not exactly sure about the details of the technology they used, but they deployed a drone and they located Stumpf and Stiles in this attic. They refused to come out. After an hours long standoff, they eventually captured them or took them into custody. Stumpf is from Claremont County. According to court documents, that's where his address is listed, out there in Claremont County. Stiles, Hall, and Hamilton all live in Arlington Heights, and their addresses are all listed as the same address in Arlington Heights. They're on Erkenbrecher Avenue. So they all could live together if the court documents are correct.
And this Terry Stiles is a name that we've heard before in the news connected with the death of an infant in 2019, but it stemmed, I think, from an incident in 2005. What can you tell us about Terry Stiles?
Yeah, so Stiles was initially charged with felonious assault back in 2005. He was accused of assaulting an infant, his girlfriend's infant. He was not the father of that child, according to the case back then. And he pled guilty to some charges in that case, and he served 8 years in prison on that case.
That was before the infant died, right?
Right. Yeah. So fast forward to 2019. And the child had survived the attack, but had suffered some brain damage and had some disabilities as a result of all of this, according to the investigators. And that child died in 2019, and the prosecutors said he died as a result of his injuries that he suffered as an infant. So they attempted to charge Stiles with murder since the child had now died. Mm-hmm. And that was thrown out in court. It was dismissed by a judge who cited some prior case law that said he'd already served a sentence for a lesser offense, so he couldn't be charged again.
And we don't need to kind of go through his whole backstory, but he has a pretty lengthy criminal history, correct?
Yeah.
On top of that.
Yeah, on top of that, there's some drug charges that he's been accused of, some other things like that. There's not no real charges of violence against any of the other three defendants. No prior arson for sure. No anything like that, at least locally. And we've searched nationally too on all of them too, and we haven't really found any mm-hmm. indication that any of them have done anything like this before.
Okay. I think the big question that everybody wants to know is, like, do we know a motivation? Do we know why they did this?
Well, the last we heard was that the fire investigators are still working to determine a motive. They don't know a motive. And as far as we can tell, there are also big questions remaining about how they did it. I mean, so even that is an open question at this point, not just why, but how.
Like how they set it on fire?
Right. Okay. So we don't know if, did they pour gasoline all over it? Did they do something else? Was it, we just don't know anything about how it was set, and we don't know why it was set. And so I assume more information will come out as these trials continue.
Yeah, what happens
maybe
next?
Maybe we can learn more.
When are they back
in
court?
So two of, or I think actually, I'm not sure of the level of felonies, but these cases all need to go to a grand jury first. So the grand jury will convene. They'll decide if maybe more charges will be filed. Maybe the charges will be amended. Maybe the grand jury will say, we don't think there's enough evidence to continue the case, and they'll be dropped. That all can happen at grand jury. That's supposed to happen in two of the cases. It's supposed to happen by December 17th. In the other two cases, it's supposed to happen by the 20th of this month, but very likely it will happen sometime before then. But it's the scheduling for grand juries is a little odd and a little fluid.
Yep. All right. Well, when they are in court, we will have it covered, as I'm sure will Cincinnati Inquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. Thank you so much for your time today, Cameron.
Thank you, Tana. Have a good day.
You too. All right, the deal is off. A judge this week blocked the massive merger between supermarket giants Kroger and Albertsons. Now, Albertsons is turning on Kroger. Here to explain is WCPO 9 News iTeam reporter Dan Monk. Happy Friday the 13th, Dan.
Same to you, Tana. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right, let's start at the beginning. Explain how we got here. Kroger and Albertsons announced in, 2022 they were going to merge, right?
That's right. And they argued that they needed to merge in order to compete against larger rivals like Amazon and Walmart and Costco. And that was their central argument, all the way through this litigation. And basically what happened this week was that a judge found just the opposite, that Kroger and Albertsons do not compete mainly against Amazon and Walmart, that they compete against each other. And so what the judge ruled was that there is substantial head-to-head competition between these two companies, and if they merge, they would remove that competition. Therefore, the deal is presumptively unlawful.
And
it violates antitrust rules.
Right. And there were essentially two rulings this week, right?
Yes, there was a Washington judge that ruled along very similar findings. You know, the whole argument that Kroger was trying to make was that that the courts should look at this as a larger pool of competitors, not just supermarkets competing against each other. And both judges rejected that notion, as previous judges have. And so that was basically what it came down to. In the federal case, the judge also said that Kroger didn't provide an adequate remedy by agreeing to sell hundreds of its stores to a company called C&S Wholesale Grocers. And they thought that the deal would not lead to a viable competitor competing against the newly merged company.
So that's a lot of talk about competitors, but did the judge say anything about what a merger would mean for customers?
Well, the presumption was that without competition, prices would go up. There was a lot of testimony and a lot of evidence presented in the trial that Kroger and Albertsons compete against each other head-to-head on price. And that is the reason that this is unlawful, mm-hmm. and that is that it's anti-competitive under antitrust rules, because consumers would end up paying higher prices if competition is removed.
All right. So how did Albertsons respond to the court rulings this week?
Well, they canceled the deal. That was the first thing they did. And then they sued Kroger for billions of dollars. And they said that the Kroger caused the merger to fail by ignoring the feedback of regulators and rejecting stronger divestiture buyers. So they are seeking not only the $600 million termination fee that's required by the deal, but also hundreds of millions of dollars more. They spent $400 million on legal and other expenses related to this merger. They want that money back, plus they're seeking damages for, you know, the money that their shareholders lost from a falling stock price, because for a long time it's looked like this deal was going to fail, and it ultimately did.
All right. They said, bestie, we out. What did Kroger say?
Well, Kroger said those charges were baseless and without merit. And they also said that they don't want to pay the breakup fee. They don't want to pay that $600 million to Albertsons. They said that Albertsons committed multiple breaches of the merger agreement, not cooperating with them in the process. And by the way, Kroger has already spent $658 million on this merger as well.
Ooh,
you know, the additional $600 million would take it over $1 billion just for Kroger's expenses.
So do they now fight this out in court as well?
Yes, there's a case that's pending in Delaware, and you know, it's really too early to say how that's going to go. I talked to one expert who said it's really a fight over that $600 million termination fee. And so the other interesting thing is that there continues to be reaction from this deal. Just today, the UFCW, the union that represents grocery workers at Albertsons and Kroger, called for the resignation of Rodney McMullen, the CEO of Kroger, saying that they announced a $7.5 billion share repurchase program the day after the merger. And that's an irresponsible action in their opinion, because they think that money should be put into growing the business and lowering prices.
How does that share repurchase thing work?
Well, when a company buys its shares, that reduces the overall number of shares that are outstanding. And so it improves your earnings per share, which is a major driver of stock price. So it's a very shareholder friendly proposal to say we're going to buy back company shares. This is money that Kroger probably would have spent on, completing the merger, improving Albertsons stores. And so now that they have this cash available, they're giving it back to shareholders in a sense.
How is this ruling likely to affect local Kroger employees, that work at corporate, since Kroger is headquartered here in Cincinnati, and also folks that work in your local Kroger store?
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's going to have much of an impact on the Cincinnati grocery market, because Albertsons doesn't compete here. And so that's a non-factor. Mm-hmm. And it also looks like Kroger is going to continue to grow. Several analysts who follow the company have said that Kroger has a lot of different ways of growing that had nothing to do with the merger, and they expect that growth to continue, albeit at a slower pace than it was before. So it doesn't look like Kroger will have to cut any corporate jobs, and they're doing pretty well in this market. They have a 50% market share in Cincinnati already. So,
will it affect customers at all? Are eggs going to go up again?
I don't think so. I mean, Kroger already takes a portion of its profits and plows it into lowering prices. And they have a lot of digital offers that lower prices further. They do compete on price head to head against all of their competitors in Cincinnati. And as I say, they've got a 50% market share. So it isn't likely that any of this is going to cause direct impacts on pricing, on local employment, or really the way Kroger is doing business. They're going to continue with the strategies they've had in place prior to this merger, and they're just going to try to put it behind them.
Is it, I mean, to that point, though, is it a bit of a black eye? I mean, during the merger trial, I think sometime this summer, a Kroger executive admitted to gouging prices on certain items, you know, taking them above inflation levels during this time.
Yeah, it's a bit of a black eye. I mean, the call for Rodney McMullen's resignation today, that's, you know, one example of the reputational damage that Kroger has suffered during this fight, and there are analysts who say they mishandled the conversations with the Federal Trade Commission. You know, that's an amount, that's a something that's in dispute. Like, the, you know, some people say the Federal Trade Commission was out to halt this merger from the beginning. There's nothing that Kroger could have done in order to compromise. But I've talked to analysts who also say there was an attempt to compromise maybe a year ago, and Kroger missed the boat on that. They thought that they had a strong case, and the rulings of this week show that at least two judges totally disagreed with them. They were very decisive rulings in favor of the FTC and against Kroger.
Now, not to suggest that Albertsons is small, because it is a very large grocery chain, but will they, you know, in markets where they are, see negative impacts, or will it be similar to how Kroger's coming out okay?
Well, I think Kroger, or Albertsons rather, is going to have a rougher time of it going forward than Kroger. One reason they did this deal is because they recognized they were too small to compete against some of these larger companies. And in the 2 years that this deal has taken to process, Albertson's competitive position has weakened. Kroger's hasn't gotten any worse, but it hasn't gotten stronger either. And I've talked to some analysts who say that Amazon is really beefing up its distribution capabilities, and they are deeply discounting some of the services that you can get now that directly compete against Kroger and Albertsons. So, you know, when they say they needed this merger to compete against Amazon and Walmart, they weren't lying about that. They actually will have a harder time, both companies, competing against these larger entities.
Is it even harder now that they've kind of had this big public breakup?
Yeah, I think it will be harder for Kroger, not because they've gotten worse, but because Amazon has gotten better in the 2 years while they were working on this merger. Kroger does have a lot of you know, strategies that can lead to growth. They're becoming one of the country's biggest advertising revenue generators with the direct messages that they can send to consumers who are shopping in their stores on behalf of consumer goods companies like Procter & Gamble. So they have ways of growing their revenue, you know, that don't rely on head-to-head competition between one grocer and another.
All right. Now, not to ask you to speculate, but to ask you to speculate,
yeah.
I've seen some speculation on the internet that Kroger and Albertsons never even expected that this was actually going to get through. Like, they knew it was sort of too big and they were doomed from the start,
yeah,
and they did it for some strategic reason. What can you say to that?
No, I don't think that's the case. Kroger believed, I know Kroger thought that they needed this merger in order to compete against bigger companies. I think they also thought that they had a very strong legal argument. Maybe what they didn't count on was that the Federal Trade Commission would come out with such a strong case. And they stuck to their guns. You know, before this merger, what usually happened in grocery mergers was that the acquiring companies would sell off a certain number of stores in order to reduce the loss of competition that they would have in markets where these two companies competed head to head. I think that's what Kroger thought would happen in this case, and that didn't happen. The FTC stuck with its argument that this thing is anti-competitive. They even introduced a new antitrust argument, which was that the merger would harm employees by reducing the bargaining power between union bargaining units. Albertsons and Kroger are both union employees. They argued that if they merged, the unions wouldn't be able to play the companies off each other at when they were collectively bargaining for a new contract. And the judge said that was a plausible legal theory, but she said there wasn't enough evidence that union workers would actually be harmed if Kroger and Albertsons merged. So that was an interesting outcome of this case. That's just an example of how differently the FTC approached this case than they did prior grocery mergers.
And so looking ahead then, do you think under this new Trump administration, will we see other big mega merger efforts like this? And if you think we will, how successful do you think those efforts might be?
It's really not clear whether, President-elect Trump's nominee for the FTC chair position and the nominee for a new FTC commissioner, both of them are not expected to aggressively fight mergers, but they are expected to regulate price. So Kroger and Albertsons could face additional regulation in that area. They're not likely to bring another merger back after this loss, at least not anytime soon. So I think that's how the landscape will change. If there is any regulation of the grocery industry, it will be around getting prices lower. It won't be around blocking mergers.
I've been speaking with WCPO 9 News I-Team reporter Dan Monk. Thank you so much for talking with us, Dan, and explaining how it all works.
Thank you.
Up next, a Cincinnati Public Schools restructuring plan gets approval, meaning some students will be on the move next year. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Tana Weingartner, filling in for Lucy May. Cincinnati Public Schools Board of Education on Monday night approved a much-debated plan to restructure and move students for the 2025-2026 school year. The plan is meant to address overcrowding in some areas and under-enrollment in others. And it has undergone some changes. Here to explain those changes and what's ahead is WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Welcome back, Zach. All right, so we're going to have Zach try a different microphone, and he's having trouble hearing me at the moment. So while he's doing that, we'll just sort of refresh what's been going on with the Cincinnati Public School Board of Education. There's something called Phase 2, which they have said they need to restructure all the schools, like where each students go. And some of them have too many students, some of them have too few students. So they have to sort of figure out, because of some state laws that I don't understand, frankly, they have to move some of those students around. So they came up with this plan, the superintendent did, and she brought it to the school board on Monday night. Well, she brought it to them a few weeks ago. She brought this whole plan. But people were not big fans, right? All right, Zach is now here. We've got him on a different microphone. Let's see if it works. Hi, Zach.
Hi, hello.
Okay, all right, we can hear him now. All right, so tell us a little bit. I just sort of kind of recapped for folks why CPS says it needs to restructure, but you can give us like the actual facts here.
Yeah. So, and you did a good job of describing it there. I'll give you some credit. So basically what this plan was, this was presented by now permanent superintendent Shauna Murphy. When she introduced this, she was interim at the time. But basically what this was pitched as a way to kind of optimize some of the district's facility operations. So the idea is saving some money on transportation, saving some money on building costs and things like that, maintenance, that sort of thing. And the plan was to do that by combining certain schools. So CPS says a lot of their elementary schools around town, and that's Eastside, Westside, Central, that's a lot of them, are under-enrolled, so underutilized buildings. So part of the plan was combining those elementary schools so they were closer to being at capacity. Mm-hmm. And take one of those schools that had to move and use that building to create a middle school. And they're doing that to solve the problem of overcrowding at some of the high schools. So currently, a lot of CPS high schools right now have 7th through 12th grade. And what they're doing is they're taking those 7th and 8th graders out of some of those schools, putting them into new middle schools. So this was all part of this larger plan called Phase 2. Okay. And basically, this was originally pitched as one big package for the school board to assess and eventually vote on. As they did some community engagement on this, they ended up breaking this up into pieces and voting on those pieces individually, which is what we have now.
Okay, so how many schools and students would the original plan have affected if it all had gone together?
So around 30 schools and thousands of students, a lot.
Okay.
So this version of the plan that was eventually approved is most of that. So it includes a lot of those 30 schools, but certain ones were taken out. And certain ones in particular, we're looking at Clark Montessori. We're looking at Hayes Porter and Rothenberg Academy. And we're also looking at Woodford Academy and Silverton.
Okay.
So those were adjusted and not supported by much of the school board. So we had a handful of schools kind of taken out of this plan, which is where we stand now.
And when you said they were not supported, I mean, explain what happened at this meeting on Monday.
Well, this was a six and a half hour meeting, one of the longest ones that I have been to. And it went that long because somewhere around like 50 or 60 people came to speak at this meeting about this plan because it touched so many schools, so many communities. And some of the major groups there was Hayes Porter. Woodford had been coming to these meetings for weeks, really since this news kind of first came out about this plan, telling the district that they didn't want this. They wanted to stay put and stay where they are. They were proud of their schools. They were proud of how they were doing academically, and they wanted to keep things as is. So really the reason why those particular schools were taken out of this plan and not approved was because of the community response. They were, you know, persistent. They showed up every time there was public comment, and they made their voices pretty clear.
So are they, you know, like, shoo, home safe? Or, you know, just because they were, you know, carved out of this, could something still happen later?
It can always still happen. Certainly Clark Montessori, the idea was to take 7th and 8th graders out of Clark and put them into a Montessori middle school. That plan was slashed for right now, but certainly they're still open to doing that eventually, and it could happen you know, not next fall, but the year after that. So I think these things are still on the table. There is also a phase 3 that the administration is starting to put together now, and that includes some building sales and some expansions of certain schools. So I don't think anybody feels totally safe quite yet. So the answer to that is no.
Okay. Well, which schools are going to close for sure?
Well, we're looking at, let me look at my list here.
We like to come prepared with notes.
So we have Evanston Academy is going to join Frederick Douglass. So that building, Evanston, is going to be South Avondale Middle School. So basically, you know, the names are going away. The schools are going away. They're not going to be elementary schools anymore, but those buildings are going to be new middle schools. So we do have a number of elementary schools that are going to be shuttering and then eventually turning into middle schools next year.
Okay. Just kind of going back, I guess, I mentioned it kind of in the intro that the schools that have under enrollment right now, this isn't just that Cincinnati Public Schools decided, hey, there's under enrollment here, we need to close it. They're actually required under state law. Is that correct?
Yeah, there is a state law right now that requires public school districts do have a certain percentage of utilization. That percentage is 60%. It's not clearly defined what that 60% means. Is it classroom space? Is it number of students in the building? And it's not really totally clear what that exactly means. So it's been kind of hard to define and really make decisions on that. I think the school district partly made this decision out of financial reasons and partly some pressure from the state. There, that existing law, that 60% law, there's another bill, 295, which is currently in the state house right now in committee, I believe, still. And, you know, that could add some teeth to that existing law and basically enforce it, because it hasn't really been totally enforced over the past couple years. So part of this plan was in preparation of that. But I think mostly the motivation for this was financial.
Okay. And I should mention that Lucy May will be back next week for Cincinnati Edition. They're going to be talking with one of the lawmakers about that on the program on Tuesday. So be sure to tune in. I know Zach will be paying attention to that. Just real fast, I want to pivot to where you were this morning. You came running in here, folks, to be on the show. We're so thankful that he did that. You were up in Oxford, where WMUB used to be housed, my precious WMUB. And just tell us real fast about what the Board of Trustees were hearing up there about Millett Hall.
Yeah, Millett Hall, the longtime basketball arena.
Where I graduated from high school.
They have plans for a new arena. It's not set in stone yet. So what the Board of Trustees did this morning was basically approve a committee that is going to assess some potential sites for a new arena. The administration wants to put it closer to the center of campus. And they also approved some funds to go to an engineering team that is going to start coming up with some designs and kind of decide how much this arena could cost and what it's going to look like and where it could feasibly go. So no arena yet.
Okay.
Nothing set in stone, but they're starting to put those plans together. And, you know, this next year we'll see what people say about it and potentially find out where it could land.
And it's controversial because they're considering Slant Walk area.
Slant Walk, yeah. The historic green space, 200 years old.
All right. I've been talking with WVXU education reporter Zach Carrion. Have a great weekend, Zach.
You too.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Tana Weingartner. Thank you so much for listening. Please tell your pets I said hello. Tell Howdy I said hello, Zach. All right. Thanks, everybody.